Greetings, humans. It's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And today's guest is J. Macon King. And he is a writer, a poet, and a publisher. He's the editor of the Mill Valley Literary Review. And it's kind of funny. I met him, last spring. He wrote me. He sent me a short story, which I thought was really good, and I ended up publishing it. And he thought that I was in New York. He didn't realize that I live in Mill Valley. And I was like, hey, you know, I live in Mill Valley. You're the editor of the Mill Valley Literary Review. And of course, it turns out he doesn't live in Mill Valley anymore. He's not so far away. But anyway, we spent some time talking about some of the other Mill Valley artists like Peter Coyote, Sam Shepard, Philip K. Dick, Martin Cruz Smith, Gerald Nicosia, Al Hinkle, and what the literary scene and art scene is like around this neck of the woods. It's actually kind of jam-packed for such a little area. And we also discussed him growing up in the Midwest and how he first came out to California in the early 70s and first moved to L.A. And then he moved to San Francisco in the 70s. And we talked about how wild and crazy, in good and bad ways, San Francisco was in the 70s. By the time it was the 90s, it was already too gentrified for him. And he said, fuck it, and moved up to Mill Valley, Marin County. So at any rate, we had a good talk. We talked about all that stuff. And then around the 50-minute mark or so, he reads a few poems. So I hope you enjoy this podcast, which, by the way, is also the last of the summer recordings. I recorded this earlier this summer, and I mentioned my good friend Steve Dalachinsky, and I guess Steve was still alive when we recorded this. God bless you, Steve, wherever you are. Rest in peace. So, this is coming out December 23rd, the day before, the night before Christmas. So, Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Peaceful solstice to you all. Without further ado, here's my conversation with J. Macon King. All right, so today's guest is John King, aka J. Mason King, and he's a writer, he's a poet, he's a publisher, and I've just found out he's also an actor, a singer, a director. He's a true Renaissance man.
John Macon King.
John Macon King. Yeah. Sorry. So, like the Macon County line?
Yeah, Macon, Georgia.
Yeah. Where did you get that middle name from?
My grandpa and mother had Southern roots.
So you had Southern roots? Where is your family from originally?
My mom was from Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
And we spent a lot of summers down in like the boondocks of Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
And see, she always had like this nice Southern Tennessee accent when she moved up to Illinois when she married my dad.
And that's where you grew up.
I grew up close to St. Louis.
Uh-huh. And what did your folks do?
My dad was a machinist in a factory. He was a classic factory guy, and my mom was a housewife and dabbled in, you know, like the waitressing and house cleaning when we needed the money.
Uh huh. Okay. And so you wrote a story, which people can find in Sensitive Skin, about your coming out to California. How old were you when you came out here?
I think when I first came out, I was probably 19. Mm-hmm. 19, first year of college, and then my mind expanded in all new worlds, and I decided to get the heck out of Illinois for a while, and I hitchhiked across the country by myself.
Uh-huh.
Initially, I was going to ride my motorcycle with my girlfriend, and then she bailed on that, and so I decided just to hitchhike by
myself.
Was that
like the summer after college or
something? Yeah, summer after first college, yeah.
Did you go back to college, or did you stay?
So I toured out to California and visited San Francisco the first time, and then I actually headed up the coast hitchhiking, and I got picked up farther up north after a number of adventures by a couple of guys from Boston, Sudbury, Massachusetts. And they were on their way to Mexico, but they didn't have their passports. They decided to go to Canada instead. And so I ended up hitchhiking up to Alaska with him across the Alcan back when it was just a dirt and gravel road. And then we, after rolling the Volkswagen over and almost getting stepped on by a moose and a number of other adventures, we headed back all the way across Canada, and I hung out in the Boston area for a while before coming back to Illinois for my second year of college.
That's a heck of a summer.
Yeah, so yeah, I packed a lot in.
Did they ever pave the Alcan? I mean, that's the last
I
I
think
heard. It
most of
was
it's
still
paved now, from what
okay.
I understand.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
the last I guess it's a long time ago, but I remember people talking about like, oh yeah, it's like 2,000 miles of dirt road that you got to go,
Yeah.
to
And
get
we
up
were in
to
this like
Alaska.
classic little hippie VW bug. And like I said, we rolled it over. One time we were looking for bighorn sheep at the mountains, and the Volkswagen just tipped over, and we're all holding beers. And fortunately, even that time, we were all strapped in, amazingly enough, in our seat belts. So we're upside down with our beers pouring out, strapped into our seats.
Oh man, what a terrible waste of beer.
So we were able to get out, push the car back over, kick out the rest of the broken windshield. Started raining, put oil in the car, put the battery back in, put sunglasses on, and continued on our way
Yeah, those
until
things
we
were
got.
kind of indestructible, weren't
They
they?
were.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was an adventure. But then, so I suffered through like another year of college, and I just wasn't into it. And I was already racing motorcycles at that point for a Kawasaki dealership and doing flat track and motocross. And so I thought I might, go out to California and try to become a professional motorcycle racer. But so I hooked up with my older friend Dick, and kind of a quasi girlfriend of mine. Or would-be girlfriend Laurie and her little beagle dog Dylan, and in this old panel van, and we headed out again and through Colorado and on out west, and we started having some disagreements up around Seattle area, and so I just bailed out and said, you take the girl, the dog, the truck, and I'm out of here. So I ended up hiking down
It
to
sounds like the line from Apocalypse Now, right? His the letter that Colonel Kurtz wrote to his wife, take the house, the kids, the dog,
Oh, right.
the car.
Yeah, maybe that's where I got that. And so I ended up in Hollywood at still I think age of maybe 20, and with a couple of friends down there, and then spent a couple of years down in LA and Hollywood. At which point I was, took some classes. I was an extra in a movie, a black exploitation movie called Black Samson.
Oh wow. So
And
this is when, back in the like early
this
70s or
was
something?
in 73 to 75.
Okay.
I was in LA. I lived in Santa Monica, at a nice, really nice place there. I spent a lot of time on the beach, and had a, I did have a motorcycle, rode up through the canyons, and had some of the adventures I talked about in the story, 20 Feet from Enlightenment.
Yeah. And have you stayed out here since then, or?
Yes, except for a few trips back to the Midwest to visit the family early on. I've been a permanent resident of California.
And when did you start writing?
I've kind of written since high school. I was always writing. And then I actually took a writing class at Santa Monica City College. And then I started getting into music when I was in San Francisco, after I moved up to San Francisco, where I lived for many years in the Haight-Ashbury. I lived there for about 10 years. And I started taking music classes at San Francisco State. I was in a number of bands, so I started writing lyrics.
Oh, what did you play?
I was a lead singer and rhythm guitar player.
Okay.
And I was in two or three bands, and went one time in a recording studio, and we'd play different parties and gigs and bars and one thing or another, and so I was writing poetry, lyrics, verse, and for the songs. And then I unfortunately didn't really write. I think I wrote some notes and some adventurous stories of personal affairs. But I wasn't really creative writing, and which I think it was kind of a drawback. I wish I had started writing earlier.
So what was something that's kind of fascinating me? What people always talk about Haight-Ashbury in the 60s, you know, and then it was, you know, overrun by, you know, all the media coverage and whatever, and hundreds of thousands of runaway kids coming there in the 60s or whatever. I'm kind of fascinated by what it must have been like in the 70s, and like how, just how generally, I think a lot of people don't know, this is something that I learned after I moved out here, but just how incredibly fucked up San Francisco was in the 70s, right? With like, yeah, with like the Symbionese Liberation Army and, you know, the Jim Jones and,
right,
you know, the Zebra Killers and the Zodiac. And there's just like so much of that stuff going on. Was that like something that you were aware of at the time, or did it
absolutely. It was hard not to be aware of it. And all of it had a big impact and effect. And, in fact, I wrote, maybe later on I'll read a poem I wrote about that time in San Francisco.
Okay.
But, you know, there's a book called Season of the Witch, about the 70s.
Right. Which is where I learned about a lot of this stuff. Yeah.
And a very, very well written book. And, you know, and it has even information in there that, you know, most people are not privy to, but the background and all that. But yeah, it was pretty crazy times. And, you know, there was still aspects of the peace, love, and LSD, and let's get along. But there were, you know, there was definitely, you know, bad people doing bad things, and you know, power trips and charismatic leaders, mm-hmm, and all that, which, you know, people didn't necessarily have to get involved with. But anytime you're involved with activities in Hate Street or involving drugs, there's always an element of danger. And you know, somebody was killed like right outside my apartment, mm-hmm, by Golden Gate Park, actually by right by Kezar Stadium, with the, you know, of Dirty Harry fame, and I think that could have been a bullet for me.
I actually tried to watch that recently. It did not age well.
Now, the San Francisco scenes are good though.
But I mean, that's basically what the movie is about. He's like, he's kind of like the last true, like, you know, moral American guy, and he's just sick of everything that's going on. But you know, it's like incredibly racist. It's incredibly misogynist. It's incredibly homophobic. You know,
the 70s.
Which is funny. I didn't remember it seeing, like, when I saw it as a kid, that I guess that was, you know, the water we were swimming in or whatever.
But, right. It's obviously easy to be in retrospect, you know, consider everybody, you know, racist or homophobic or whatever, but that's kind of the way it was. And if you weren't like a saint, it was hard to, like you said, swim to the surface of that and be above that. But there was some, you know, genuine serious, you know, race issues and problems and neighborhoods you know shouldn't go into as a white person. And mm-hmm, you know, there was crime and muggings and things like that. And but you know, I was you know, I lived in the Castro district too. I was there for the in the mid 70s to, I guess it was more late 70s, kind of the gentrification, where there was so many gay people you know, on the crystal staircase, as they called it, with like money from their parents or whatever, and investing in bars and restaurants. And mm-hmm, I saw Hate Street totally change in you know, the late 70s, and you know, the I-Beam opened, and a lot of clubs, you know, turned, and the Polk Street and Castro Street and all that. And so there was some pushback and resentment from that. And, that kind of the changing of the guard, but it was a lot of fun, despite all the, headline news and bad things going on. I think the '70s and a little bit into the '80s was kind of the last time where people could really be free and, no judgment against anything they do. And you know, somebody could walk around naked, for example, and there wouldn't be any judgment, or you know, any number of things.
I still see people in San Francisco walking around naked.
Right, but,
and I'm like, get a towel, man. Come on.
You know,
I know. Just sit on a towel. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a whole kind of movement of that. I think a lot of that's exhibitionism, but before it was just kind of being free. You know?
All right, so let me ask you, as somebody who didn't get here till 2007. Although I'd visited California and San Francisco, I guess the first time I was a little kid, actually. I came here in like 1967, and I vaguely remember going on one of those tourist buses through the Haight.
Oh, come on, you did that?
Yeah. And there was I remember, it's so funny, the things you remember when you're a kid. I was like 6 years old, and there was like a woman who had like knee-length black hair who had a really long cigarette holder and was smoking a joint. And my parents were going like, oh my God, that woman's smoking marijuana. Anyway, and then I came back a few times. I came back in 82, and then I had friends. I came out like a couple of times in the late 90s. But I guess my question is, like, when did San Francisco go to hell?
Yeah, well,
becoming a place that became like, it's always had this the reputation as this like free flowing place where you can go and, you know, I do your own thing. And it didn't.
Right.
You know, I have friends who I've got a good friend who, you know, was a runaway teenager and lived in the Haight in the 60s. And she was like, yeah, there were 15 of us living in the Victorian. My rent was $30 a month. I worked 2 days a month at the supermarket. And I mean, those days are long. But so when did it really start to become, you know, like the tech bro hell that it is now?
Yeah, well, it's I think after Dianne Feinstein got in as mayor, I think things started changing quite a bit after Moscone and Milk were assassinated.
Probably in the
80s, the architecture started changing. A lot of development came in, and it was still okay, you know, it was still all right. But people kind of, you know, first time they tried to vote in a ballpark in San Francisco, it was voted down because mm-hmm. they were afraid of congestion or whatever. But, you know, now it's in and it's okay, and it's a nice park. But, but you know, I think people started, you know, voting in people that probably shouldn't have voted in. They really didn't know how to run much of anything or a city, mm-hmm. you know, and you kind of get what you get then if somebody just runs on, say, an environmental platform. You kind of get somebody that maybe doesn't know really about business or the real world. So uh-huh. it just seemed to kind of get worse and worse. And I left San Francisco in 85. I was living in North Beach.
Okay.
And it was so much garbage and congestion and mm-hmm. parking issues and so forth. And that's when I moved to Marin. Uh-huh. But so probably by then I loved San Francisco. I still do. But I think the writing was kind of on the wall by then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess it was probably the same in New York at that time. But it's kind of funny. It happened in phases, right? Like mm-hmm. all through the 70s, New York was dirt cheap to live in. And there was like the punk rock scene flourished because of that.
Right.
But I didn't move to New York till 84. And it was already, there was a lot of changes going on, but at the same time, there were still places you could find cheap rent. There were still, you could still live on next to nothing. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of true for all the way through the 90s. You know, it really started changing when Giuliani became mayor. Mm-hmm. But now it's, I guess, and it's maybe the same in San Francisco as after, like, you know, like the later 2000s, like 2010 or so, when things started getting, like, New York is just ridiculous now.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I think you mentioned earlier about the .com. Yeah, they took over.
Right, so it happened, you know, here with the .com.
Yeah, the little area there, South Park, it's actually called. And
right.
And then grew from there, and they were bringing in money, and the rents went up. And as I said, you know, the gentrification really started, you know, earlier, but and then it just kind of kept going. And you know, there was, even as you know, as even in Marin County, there was affordable housing. The whole area was kind of affordable housing,
right.
But it wasn't until they knocked down the affordable housing and built mansions,
right.
And you know, right. And the, drove the real estate prices. Then suddenly, there's no affordable housing. It's like, well, we did have that, but
right.
You know,
right.
Now we have to build separate, right. You know,
but
housing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like on the same wavelength, because it's like here, it's just like what's happened now is like now Oakland is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where it used to be, you could, like, you know, move, you know, you could live in Oakland for fairly cheaply.
Or, right, and there's areas in Oakland that are as expensive as Marin, like, you know, was it Rockland or I think that's the name of the area there.
Or the hills there, though.
Yeah, or the hills, the yeah. Hills, and, yeah. Yeah, very, very expensive. But the rest of it's, you know.
Yeah, but it's interesting. It kind of came in waves, right? So the same. So, I mean, I know there was the whole. So I guess things. I came here in the late 90s, and I remember things were getting. Seemed really expensive, although they're probably, in retrospect, dirt cheap compared to what they are now,
right.
But seemed really expensive to me.
Well, the second house I bought in Mill Valley was, I think I got $320,000 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, and you know, which was, you it know, seemed like a lot at the time, and yeah. Now you can't touch anything like that for under $1 million.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And it's unfortunate it's happening everywhere. But so right. When did you start the magazine?
The magazine I started, I'm in my eighth year, and so I guess that would have been 2012.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's funny how it started, because before that, as you know, I was directing and producing and writing theater, you know, one acts and mm-hmm. skits and that kind of thing, and my whole concept of that was really to get just normal people involved.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wasn't putting a casting call out for professional actors or whatever. I wanted, you know, so I got in housewives. I got in the fire chief.
Uh-huh.
I
uh-huh.
got in the guy at the supermarket. I, you know, just anybody that would come in the door I met, I said, hey, how would you like to be in a show or be involved? And, you know, I'd talk them on, if they were any good at all or, you know, photogenic, I'd try to put them on stage. Otherwise, I'd put them, you know, in the tech or backstage or whatever. Uh-huh. And so it was a real, and I really wanted to have a real community theater because I revived one that had been running since the 50s, the Rhubarb Review, now it's the longest running variety show, I think, at least in Northern California, and it's still going. So in the year 2000, I started that, and with that concept, getting people involved. So the magazine is kind of similar to that in a way that it's not just about famous writers or established writers. Mm-hmm. I try to get people out of the community or just regular people that, you know, to write and submit. And so I publish a lot of, you know, fairly new people. They're, you know, they're good. We, you know, we vet them, of course. But, and, you know, I still throw in ringers like I did in the Rhubarb Review. I had, you know, a professional or two or three mm-hmm. in the show to raise up the level.
Sure.
In the same way in the magazine, I get, you know, interview, you know, well-known writers and have, you know, professional writers material in there too. But so my wife and I were sitting around. We have what we call martini night on Friday nights, and I make a great cocktail. And we found martinis are very inspirational. And we'd start chatting, brainstorming things and ideas, and the creative juices would flow. And at one point, I said, you know, I've always liked the idea of interviewing people. I think it'd be great just to, you know, there's so many interesting people around. I want to interview people. And she goes, well, how would that look? And I said, I don't know, maybe like in a magazine, but, you know, maybe I could just run my own magazine and put interviews in it. She goes, okay, you know, go ahead. I go, okay. So you said, started a whole theater and, you know, produced and directed and wrote for, you know, that for 4 or 5 years, you can, you know, magazine sounds easy enough. You've had some experience uh-huh. in writing a community magazine and so forth that went out to like 3,000 people. So,
it was originally a print magazine?
It was never a print magazine. It was
okay.
from the beginning, I always wanted to save costs and mm-hmm. time. And because I'd gone through that and printing programs for the show
right.
and printing the community newsletter, you know, there's, you know, it's proofreading and cost and paper.
Yeah.
And
I know.
This. And so yeah. I said, forget it. I'm going to do this as cheap as I can. You know, I'm a computer guy. I know how to web design. I'll just make my own web zine. And, you know, I put one up, and Paul Libertor, creative writer for the IJ, Marin IJ local paper, he caught wind of it, you know, interviewed me, wrote a big piece of it, sent out a photographer, and, you know, it got in the, I think, the you know, headline or, you know, center section of the culture, you know, part of the paper. And, you know, and next thing I know, it was like a magazine publisher.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of went from there. And so I just tried to, you know, make it better and better and getting, you know, more interviews. And it's been great.
So who are some of the so our audience knows what to check out. Who are some of the maybe better known people who you've published over the years?
Published or interviewed?
Well, either one.
Okay. Yeah. I mean,
and I know it's easier to get a famous, successful writer to do an interview,
right,
than to give you work.
Because they want to sell it, and I don't want to pay them.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it's an impasse. But
I knew one very well known writer who I'm not going to say his name, but you know, I asked him if he wanted to be in Sensitive Skin, if he wanted to give me something for Sensitive Skin. He said, "I'd love to, but I can't, you know, give you a short story for less than $5,000 because that's what I could get for it somewhere else." And I was like, "I understand, but you know."
Right.
So
yeah. So, but you know, I've had local writers and, you know, who've published a number of books. Like Christy Nelson, she's published 3 books. her last book, Beautiful Illusion, about the World's Fair and Treasure Island, 1939, was a big success. You know, she's published a number of travelogues and little shorts in the magazine. Susanna Solomon, who writes wonderful, wonderful short stories, and has published I think at least 2. Books of Point Reyes sheriff's logs, and which I think you would enjoy, and the little blurbs like man with dog crosses road or something, and sheriff's investigators, just these silly things, and she created these whole little stories, and she's had two books of short stories, and she's just published a novel, and she was a contributor and on staff for a while, and contributed, and she was as she was raising her success level, and she did all these readings and so forth, I'd have her report and what it was like to be a successful writer. And it turned out to be, it's a lot of work and a lot of schlepping around and talking to people and this and that, and so I've had more local people contribute to the magazine. But for the interviews, I've had some good luck. I had Peter Coyote, who was a local person here in Marin, and for many, many years. And he talked about the Diggers and Haight Ashbury, and what it was like with the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and how he came out from New York, and a lot of really interesting facts on that. And,
yeah.
He actually wanted to be a writer too before he became an actor and narrator.
Right. And I heard an interesting story. It's Sam Shepard, who also used to live in Mill Valley.
Right.
And wrote like his most famous plays while he was living here. Somehow knew Peter, like socially,
and
said, like, "I think you'd be great in my play." He'd never acted before, and he just, I think he put him in the first version of True West or something like that.
Exactly, at the Magic Theater in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I have a poster from that.
Yeah, and it's funny, I think there's still people who I say the name Peter Coyote, and they, sometimes people don't know who he is. I'm kind of surprised, and I was like, you know him. You've heard his voice 1,000 times,
because he
does voiceovers for... Like,
oh, he's a wonderful narrator, and he's doing the Bay Area Revelations right now, which is on, I guess, PBS or something like that.
I think there's a law that if you do a documentary about San Francisco, that you have to use him as a narrator.
Right, and he goes, these Bay Area Revelations go through, the different periods of time in San Francisco, which would be quite interesting too, like that.
And what is that being presented on?
I think it's PBS.
Oh, okay.
But it's on TV, and it comes out infrequently.
Oh, cool.
But there's always something fascinating about the the gay movement, or the Dennis Perone and the legalization of marijuana, and Dennis Perone was a really advocate of legalizing marijuana, and I met him and knew him, and he was arrested countless times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting how the legalization was paved with a lot of imprisonment and
Kamala Harris.
Who's that?
Kamala Harris.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting aspect of her past, right? I mean,
of prosecution.
Yeah, that she sent a lot of people to jail for marijuana, and
right.
then was recently joking about it. Oh, sure, I smoked pot.
Right, right. Yeah, there's, yeah, there's a lot of hypocrisy.
Called out on it.
Yeah. Now, hypocrisy in politics. That's,
really?
That's for sure. Yeah, so, yeah, spoiler alert.
Yeah,
For you new voters out there. But yeah, so, and then T.C. Boyle. I met T.C. Boyle at Litquake and ran into him again at a little restaurant. And we started chatting, and we've become, kind of pen pals in a way. And so he gave me an interview, which kind of surprised me because, I called him the rock star of novelists.
Yeah, he is kind of like a rock star. He looks like a rock star. He dresses like a rock star.
Exactly. He looks like Rick Ocasek from the Cars. You know, he's tall, slim, and, dresses like
all in black.
And he has a great sense of humor, though. But I think he's one of my favorite writers today.
I think we were talking about this too. It's like I loved his stuff in the 80s and early 90s when he was writing short stories, and he would I read his short story collections, and he'd have a short story coming out regularly, like in the New Yorker or Harper's or whatever, and then I stopped reading him I just kind of forgot about him.
And he keeps writing them, though.
And he kept writing.
He's got huge books of short stories. He's kind of a master of short stories.
He's very very prolific.
A lot of them are dark and, sardonic humor. And, he admits he enjoys having bad things happen to his characters. But
I think there's a lot of writers who... I've sometimes thought there's a lot of writers who write primarily to do that.
get their
revenge on the world
out on their characters. Yeah. So and then Catherine Coulter has been interviewed in my paper. My wife did that interview. She's always on the New York Times bestseller list, and she's not an easy person to get interviewing. So that was kind of a coup.
And you had Philip K. Dick's wife, also another local for
yes.
a while.
Yes, Ann R. Dick, who lived out at Point Reyes. And sadly, she has passed away, I think, maybe a year ago.
Oh, okay.
But I probably had one of the last interviews with her, a full, complete interview. I was in her home, and she talked where Philip K. Dick lived and wrote a lot of his stories, Man in the High Castle.
Oh, is that where he wrote that one?
Yes, yeah. For example, and she was, some of her influence showed through in that novel. Yeah. But she was a writer herself, and she's written a book about Dick, and she's written poetry, and not to diminish her, and she was a jewelry maker, which came out in Man in the High Castle, In fact, the Amazon presented the Man in the High Castle TV programs about the time I met her, and we talked about watching it together. And so I had a number of conversations with her.
And when was she married to him? Because he had like five wives.
Yeah,
or something
he kept getting younger and younger wives. It seemed like, and
that's a pattern among a certain.
the successful people, I guess. Yeah, but I guess that would have been in the late 50s, early 60s.
Oh, so she was maybe like his first wife or something like that?
Think it was second.
Second,
yeah.
It's funny because I always think of him as an Oakland guy.
Right, well, he lived in Oakland.
For a long time, right? But I guess he lived in, did he live in Bolinas or Point Reyes?
Point Reyes Station. Point Reyes Station up on the Mesa area there, higher part. And then he lived right by the Civic Center, Venetia area, and that's when he started doing more of the drugs and the meth, and younger people around him, and he had some paranoid issues and so forth there.
Made some great books out of his
paranoia. Right. But not recommended to try at home.
Yeah.
Doing meth and getting paranoid to write your stories. But somehow he would just. I don't think he edited his stories. He would just write them, and they'd be like complete little segments that had so much more than what you saw in the 15 pages or whatever.
Yeah, I think he was like, he was like Kerouac. He took a lot of speed and just like typed for many hours and
nonstop.
And Man in the High Castle, I guess, is far and away his most successful book. It's the book that made him famous as a, you know, brought him some fame, I guess, at the time. I think it won a Hugo Award,
right,
best science fiction novel of the year and all that. And, but he seemed like he was writing, like, it's interesting where somebody could still, it was a time in the 60s and 70s where somebody could still eke out a living just by like knocking out 5 science fiction novels. Right.
Even it was for 12 cents a word.
For 12 cents a word, right? And like getting published by like Ace paperbacks, just like little paperbacks or whatever. But those are some of my favorite ones, though, the ones that he...
And a lot of them came out in those little sci-fi journals, you know.
Or the two-for-one books. I think I have a couple of those that cost like 50 cents or something. But,
And then as we know, you know, Hollywood's, you know, milked as many of those as they could out. And
you know, it's kind of...
Blade Runner and...
It's kind of crazy. If you'd asked me, and I loved science fiction when I was a kid. I still delve into it from time to time. I'm not as into it as I used to, but when I was, you know, when I was a teenager, I just loved stuff, loved science fiction.
Right.
And that's when I started reading him, among other people. But if you'd asked me, like, of all the writers that you really like, who's going to be, you know, just swept up by Hollywood, and they're going to turn everything he ever did, all his books, all his shorts, just one book. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Wouldn't have been the guy you first thought of, right?
No, because his stuff was so fucking
ball.
Out there,
right?
You know?
It's really out there, yeah.
And I mean, they managed to make a movie of Through a Scanner Darkly of all the, you know,
Was that the Keanu Reeves one? Was he?
Yeah. It was pretty hilarious. They actually had Richard Linklater made it.
Oh yeah, with his semi-digitized.
Yeah, I forget what they call it. It's not rotoscoping because they did a special treatment to the film. But there's the scene where they have Keanu Reeves, Winona Ryder, Robert Downey Jr., and Woody Harrelson. Like the all stoner
and his
movie
face
star
keeps
cast.
Changing or something.
He's wearing like a suit so they can't see who he is, and he's like spying on his friends, but he's also he's going in and reporting to his, you know, to his boss, and he wears the suit and the boss doesn't know who he is.
Right.
But he's also, he's spying on himself, and he gives the reports about like all the bad shit that he's been up to, you know, anonymously, like
and Total Recall
Minority Report.
Minority Report, I've read most of these stories,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and of course, like Hollywood does, it's branched off and expanded.
And of course, most famously, Blade Runner, of course, which is again very different.
It was a very short story,
Blade Runner was a book.
Do
Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Right. Was that a book?
Yeah, it was a novel. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but it was very different from the film.
Yeah, well, maybe I was thinking of something else, but it was one that was like short, but somehow it turned into a feature-length movie.
I can't remember. I think that he, shortly before he died, they were filming it, and he was on the set, and I don't think he was happy with what they were doing to it, but I think he'd really be rolling over in his grave if he saw some of the treatments of
some of his other ones. How they've overreached maybe on some of them. But the magazine's been good. It's, you know, it's given me, opened a lot of doors to meet writers and be in the writing world. And, you know, I've gotten invites to the writers' conferences. I've been to a number of writers' conferences, and kind of be able to meet, you know, writers on a more of an even peer to peer, you know, setting. And I'm a writer myself and a poet, and just the fact that, you know, being a publisher of a magazine and talking to these people, it gives you a little different cachet into the lives and how everything works.
Sure, I know exactly what you're talking about, because as a publisher of a magazine,
yes,
some people wouldn't give me the time of day if they didn't.
Right. Yeah, so you can offer something back,
instead
of just wanting something.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
And so, and you know, you know, I go to you know, say for example, the book passage, and they'll give me like a front row seat there as a writer or a backstage pass, so to speak, to you know, talk to the writer in advance, you know, and do an interview.
That's great. Yeah, I've still, it's funny. I've still, I don't know, most of the time that I've been out here, I was sadly working full-time jobs and then just doing the magazine, whatever, in my spare time. And I kind of lost my legs, you know, and I never really went out into the community here. So it's good to meet you. It's nice to, you know, meet a fellow traveler in the, in the area. But that's been changing more recently as I've, you know, not working anymore.
Yeah, well, at least for more time to devote
to get out of the house and do stuff. Yeah,
yeah.
But and it's funny just the way we met too. It's like you, I'm not sure how you hurt a sensitive skin, but you sent me that story, and you thought I was in New York.
Right. Yeah, because it seems such a New York magazine. Right.
It still kind of is because I'm still like that's where all my roots are, and you know, still have a lot of connections. So yeah, we're expanding. We've you know, getting out there in California, but know a lot of. We know a lot of people from all over the place, but at any rate, it was funny. And I was like, and you sent from Mill Valley Literary Review. Right. And I was like, you know, I live in Mill Valley. Yeah.
And I like, thought for sure you're going to be in New York.
Yeah.
You said, let's get together. Like, you know, where are you going to meet Peoria?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, I'll meet you halfway. All right. But that's, you know, the book passage is where I met Jennifer Egan also. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thanks to their setting it up. And so I had a chance to talk to her and do kind of a semi-interview with her, who is in my current issue of my magazine, and who's very interesting. As you know, she's you know, she grew up in California, but she's in New York now, and has been for a number of years.
And who's the other guy? He's and I've been meaning to like try to connect with him for years because my wife has met him.
Tom and, Barbash?
No, I'm thinking of the guy. He wrote the very very successful thrillers that took place in Russia. You know what I'm talking about? His character's name was Arkady or something like that.
Oh, I think I know what you mean. Who?
Martin Cruz Smith.
Martin Cruz Smith, yeah.
Yeah.
He lives in San Rafael, and I think he just sold his house in San Rafael. But I think he's maybe still in the area. But he hung out in Mill Valley quite a bit. Maybe lived here at
and
one
he had
point.
Some connection to book passages somehow, too. Like his wife was... work there or something? I don't know. I remember,
yeah, I think the literary scene kind of revolves around the book passage, I think. Yeah. And they work closely with the library, it seems like. And they give so many classes and writers' classes and so forth there. And so pretty much everybody's been through there. So
yeah, I need to get more connected with those guys. You know, but, But it's interesting. You're also saying earlier you never did a print version. I did. I started, you know, I tried when I revived sensitive skin. I did bring it back as a print version, and there's some nice things about that, but it's ultimately just too difficult. It's too expensive.
Yeah, unless you have financial backers, you know.
Yeah, but even so, it's just there's something really nice about the immediacy of the web.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, sometimes like. Yeah.
Immediate corrections. If you made some kind of mistake, you don't have to like, oh my god, I just printed like 3,000 copies.
Fixed. Because it's kind of a funny thing. I think anybody who's ever actually published anything on paper, whether it was a newspaper, a magazine, or a book, has had this experience. You've proofed it 10 times, and you've had friends proof it, and you've gone over it with the fine tooth comb, and you pick it up. And you open it up, and you immediately see a typo.
Right, right. As soon as you've done the copy run,
as soon as you've actually done the run, it's like within 30 seconds. You're like, what? How could I have never seen that before?
It's like the ghost of the machine, or something there. But I did want to tell you a little bit about how I started my so-called poetry career.
Okay,
you have time for that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I was, like I said, you know, I started doing, you know, song lyrics, and I've always kind of dabbled in poetry, and then I did start writing, you know, some romantic poetry, which is usually a good place for a guy to start, and you know, love poems or whatever. But my friend Ari Maslow was working at and then later managing the famous Book Depot cafe and bookstore here in Mill Valley, which is sadly closed for right now. And he started doing poetry readings there with his what he charter member would call the Live Poet Society, you know, based on the Robin Williams movie. And so he asked me if I would have come read poetry there, and I said yeah. And so I started reading poetry with his group, and then he, because Gerald Nicosia, who's the very well known beat expert and mm-hmm. novelist, not novelist, but a biographer of Kerouac and Memory Babe is
right,
one
right.
of his. One of his books, and knew his Jack's daughter Jan Kerouac, and a big promoter of the Beats, and
yeah, and that's the best Kerouac book, too.
The Memory Bay, yeah.
yeah,
and and he's a bit anyway. So he Gerald Nicosia used to do a lot of his writing, and it was his office, mm-hmm. away from home, and got to know Ari, and so it's Gerald Nicosia, and he knew everybody in the Beat world and the post Beat world, and. So some of these, Gerald Nicosia started reading, and some of the post-beat poets and beat poets would come and read. And so I'd listen to these people, and I'd go, wow, they really got the rhythm and, the writing and the passion for it, I think, which is, I thought was lacking in a lot of modern poetry or poetry I heard. So I started emulating that.
Let me ask you a question. You just brought up Gerald Nicosia. I gotta play the game. Do you know Steve Dalachinsky by any chance?
I have met him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's a friend of mine from New York.
And oh, okay.
Yeah, and he comes out here every couple of years.
Yeah, and to read then, right?
He's, he comes out here to read.
Yeah, I think he's been on a bill with me.
Believe. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these people, I hate to admit it, I didn't really know them, and then I realized who they were, but anyway, so I started doing these poetry readings, and then the movie, On the Road came out, which Gerald Nicosia consulted on,
mm-hmm.
and that was the Walter Salles movie that came out a few years ago.
What did you think of it?
I went to the screening at the Mill Valley Film Festival, and which Gerald Nicosia did a presentation mm-hmm. there, and the director was there, it's kind of mixed. It was fun to finally see. It was an unfilmable film.
Right, right.
And Coppola was involved, and it seemed like... Originally, Kerouac wanted Marlon Brando to play the role of Cassidy, which I think would have been great.
But yeah.
That's how long they've been trying to make a movie, and it finally came out. And they used a South American man, and it was filmed in Canada. So it didn't... For me, it just didn't feel American somehow, and it lacked a lot of emotional... punch to it, which even Gerald
think that's a good
admitted.
Description. Yeah, I mean, there was something lacking there, and I think you just put your finger on it. I never could quite wrap my mind around it. I was mm-hmm. kind of like, they're really trying hard here, and there's a certain level of quality to the production or whatever,
right.
but it's just, it's missing a spark.
Yeah,
there somehow,
and I think that could have been added in and made it a much better film. But
anyway,
so after that movie came out, just a few months later, what was it, like 2013 maybe? They January 2013, Gerald Nicosia asked me to read at his event, which was called Beat at the Suite, and there they had the poster, had the On the Road movie. And it was a star-studded evening. I was honored that he would invite me. It was just like a local kind of newbie poet on the scene. But, as I mentioned, Jerry Comstra was there, who wrote Frisco Kid and Weed. Al Hinkle was there, who is Ed Dunkel in Kerouac's books.
Right.
And, Railroad Man, a big influence on these guys.
Didn't he just pass away very recently?
Yeah, and just in January. He was 92 years old.
He was like the last original.
Last Man Standing.
That
was his title, because all the other people were in the On the Road book, and all the Kerouac's group were long dead. And he outlived them all, like Kerouac and Cassidy by 50 years or something. But then Joanna McClure was there,
mm-hmm.
Wavy Gravy, Clark Coolidge, a younger man, Daniel Yarian, who is a big proponent of the Beats, Jack Marshall, Ramblin' Jack Elliott played, and just a lot of big names, and it was epic night at the well known Sweetwater, which kind of who's who of everybody has played at, and that really just reading with these people and watching them, it really helped me gain confidence and with my poetry. And then after I did my reading, you know, people would buy me drinks and invited me to parties, and I felt like, hey, I've arrived. I'm on the poetry scene. I'm a real poet now. And it just kind of developed from there, and I've done lots and lots of readings since then.
Okay, do you want to read something for us now?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I have two poetry chapbooks which are currently available at Copperfields here in San Rafael. That Deconstructed Poetry was my first one, which was based on a novel that I wrote. That I didn't sell, so I just took, because it was very poetic in its writing, so I just kind of deconstructed that and turned a lot of those vignettes into poetry. And the second one is Drinking with a Dead Cat and Other Poems. So I will read, I'll start off with a West Coast Pacific Ocean poem about Big Sur.
Okay.
And this is called To Sir, S-U-R, To Sir with Love. Cragged cliffs rise to endless verde, cypress, Monterey pines, and scrub, at Willow Creek, Sand Dollar, Jade Cove, sweeps of fluid azures, sets of waves, one, two, three, four, calm, across the beckoning Pacific, waves, one, two, three, four. They ride epoxy ponies through bobbing heads of Medusa's kelp. With predatory skills, they watch, wait, hunt for the wave. Frothy peaks, boils, chop, spray, music of the crested tide, in midst of salt-laden surf, cleansing their spirits and souls. Endless paddling on tiny board boats, rewarded with glorious glides, barely beyond clutches of neck-breaking cruel rocks on beach break. How far is too far out? Waves. How high is too high? Paddle further, further still. Rip currents, undertows, tides, hooligan waves, forestall foreboding. A four-way of hold-downs, gray, black, pillow, one breath from death. Yet, they rise to walk on water like Jesus' sons, apostles of aching shoulders, penitents of stiffened backs, struggling, reborn on beaches, gritty sand and sun rays, return to sweet water of River Jordan, baptismal clear.
All right.
So I wrote that on a surf trip last year down to Big Sur with my buddies. This one is a new one. I just wrote this maybe a month ago. And it was inspired by a friend's insights while traveling his interior road. This is called The Crucible. You journey through the crucible, forging body, soul, and mind. The oddity of brazen Ulysses, the whore of Babylon by your side. You partake tinctures at the junction, stand cross-eyed at the crossroads, walk the white hot line of strife, struggle with your passions, stand mute with your pains. Why try, you cry, my life hides an allegory, where is my hope? Mere delusions of illusions, who is my savior? Does he lie in disguise? Bloody your knees in confession, take mass with your red wine, strike sharp atones for your sins, order affairs in dark desk drawers, make amends with a spouse, look over to the other side, on knocking down heaven's gate, you self-flagellate in Valhalla, you piss upon the promised land, yet you embrace the bland stranger, you comfort the riderless horse, toss a coin for the blind beggar's cup. Amalgamate all that you are and ever shall be. Shout hallelujah to your insanities. In the crucible, your life is truly forged.
All right. Can we do one more?
One more. Okay. Oh, I promised you the San Francisco.
Oh, one. Yeah. Let's get the crazy 70s San Francisco story.
Let's see. City of San Francisco. Summers of Love. Summers of Love. Golden Gate Park's vast green expanse stretched from the Haight-Ashbury to the endless Pacific. San Francisco, the city's ultraviolet spectrum, beckoned dreamers who are eager for a new life, free of restrictions, boundaries, and repressions, free of the past. For lovers, she was perfect. Haight-Ashbury, birthplace of flower power, where Peter Pans and Tinker Bells preserve Neverland as a patchwork community. Summers of Love, the time-warping revolutionary spectacle, still glowed. A vibrant mix of creatives, hippies, and newcomers, unceasing in the desire for peace of free love. The late 70s, the war was over, but peace never came. We were enticed yet repelled by excessive drugs, anything goes sexuality, the charismatic radicals and cults who stirred our pot with their dark arts. The season of the witch, illusory halcyon days of San Francisco's mad decade. Sexual alchemy. Gay investors gentrified bars, shops, cafes, entire neighborhoods, and created a mad nocturnal culture. Yet, Dr. Calgary's somnambulant would soon arouse to lay waste to the weak of flesh and to the weak of heart. San Francisco, where I met the artist and her circus of an entourage, my existence rebounded, scored, lit up, and tilted. Bretta, Bretta, Bretta.
All right. All right, John. Thanks. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right.
I appreciate your time.
All right. I'll talk to you soon. I'll see you soon.
All right.
I'll see you right now.